Evolutionary Radio. This is your host, Trevor Caritzen. Joining me, as always, my loyal and faithful co-host, Steve Mee.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? We got Masonic in the house.
I'm here, ready to go as usual. We got an interesting show today, and we have one guest to join us.
We have another Steve joining us. He's known as Mobster on the evolutionary.org and elitefitness.com forums. Ironically, his name's also Steve, so we got two Steves on today's show. It's going to be a little complicated. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
So first thing I got to ask is I see a cat beside you. Is that your only pet?
No, I've got three more muggies. This is just the one that's downstairs right now. It's a huge building, so they're upstairs eating, and this one's probably very hungry.
Muggies, is that
Muggies is another way of saying cats. Yeah,
okay, I've never heard that term before.
Oh, he's a sweet cat. My old cat used to look like him. Exactly. I think they're called tabbies or something.
Yeah, I think there's two more gingers. This is one of the boys. The original idea was going to call them Ben and Jerry's after the ice cream, but this one's Jerry. There's a ginger, there's a bully because he's a little sod, and then there's Pixie, who's the runt, but pretty much runs the place.
So, Mobster, the main reason I wanted to get you on the forum here, on the podcast here, is because people have started to get to know you on the forums. You obviously know a lot about getting strong. I know you have some pretty impressive powerlifting titles. You've put up some pretty impressive numbers. Give us your background. Kind of tell us, you know, how you got into fitness, how you got into powerlifting. Tell us a little bit about the sport of competing as a powerlifter, because, you know, that's obviously very different than...
I would say I was more of a strength athlete than a powerlifter, because although we used to have some friendly competitions, and I could do a half-decent bench press, for my body weight, I would not be a competitive powerlifter. I'd be a super heavy or a super heavy, and I'm not that good in that stuff. My field of strength, from where I've got some world-class lifts, is in his hand strength, and specifically grip stuff. I've competed in four, maybe five countries. I was one of the first of the grip guys to travel around. I think I've been to America four times, Sweden three times, Spain, Germany, and then obviously competed in the UK. So I've probably been the most traveled, even in recent times, of strength athletes. And with the grip stuff, pretty much got into that around 2000, when I'd been training for about 20 years and found out I had a talent for it. And with the knowledge and experience that you pick up after 20 years of lifting, you learn how to find your talent, develop the talent, and get stronger, so you end up being competitive. It took me about three or four years to start placing, and now that I'm coming probably towards the end of my lifting career, I pretty much only compete once a year, and I think the last 3 years on the trot I've won every time I've competed. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
So how old were you when you started, and how old are you now?
I started lifting when I was 15. I started doing the grip strength stuff when I was, I'd be 35, and I'm 53 now.
And did you take any breaks in between, or has it been nonstop since you were 15, pounding away?
Apart from when I've been injured, pretty much no breaks. Obviously, the occasional holiday. But yeah, I know from reading online on various forums, not just our forum, but the various forums, there are guys that take breaks. I haven't had a break, no. If I've been injured, I've had a break. If I've gone on holiday, I've had a break. But I haven't had 6 months off or 8 months off and then come back to lifting. I've pretty much lifted the whole time. It's part of what I do. I would say it's part of my identity. So
what injuries did you have? How old were you when you had those injuries, and how long were you out?
I'm quite a tall guy. So obviously, as I started to fill out, muscles popped into the gaps. But there's been times when I've pushed myself in terms of injuries. So like a lot of guys that lift weights, I've hurt my back at times. The one which I've mentioned on the forum since I've joined was probably the big injury for me. And that would be last year, where local people would have seen me on crutches, sweating in the street. I couldn't go to the supermarket for more than 20 minutes. I would, if I was doing the washing up upstairs, I'd have to lay on the floor three or four times in 5 or 10 minutes just to do the washing up and silly things. And that took about 3 months out. When I came back into the gym, I very much knew that I had to reduce all the weights and numbers and whatever else that I'd been doing down to about 60% and start back up. But since then, I've got some stuff that's come back. I've done a record since then. I've competed since then. So I did have to get my head around the whole idea of being that badly injured and crawling around on the hands and knees and using the crutches and stuff. But fortunately, I was able to recover.
Well, what caused the injury? Was it weight training or was it something else that you
think? I think there was a particular event that involved me holding a weight slightly away from the body in a bent over position, which probably aggravated it. But truth be known, from the x-rays and the MRIs, I suspect the diagnosis of wear and tear on a couple of the lumbar vertebrae and a bulge, which I believe I'd had for years anyway, had been aggravated by wear, tear, time and heavy weights. And that particular lift probably just enhanced it a little bit more, trying to get another record, get another trophy, get another title. And it bit me on the arse, and maybe I needed it to remind me that I'm not superhuman, that I need to do certain things or whatever. Sometimes we need to do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. A lot of guys can have career-ending injuries with tears and worse. I got lucky. I recovered and I've come back. So, you know, but still, it's still a reminder I'm mortal, not superhuman.
Did you have a labor job most of your life too, where you're like kind of pounding your back doing that? Or did you have more of a white collar job where you're not pounding?
I'm kind of half and half. I did have I was talking to guys recently that some of my jobs back in the day, one particular job back in the day, I would run to work. I was doing a physical laboring job there for 7.5 years, unloading sides of beef and sides of pork for the first year, and doing other physical labor in a factory environment for a few years at that particular point in time. And I was training and I was doing taekwondo. I was a lot younger and I could do crazy stuff. My job since then has pretty much been kind of half and half, because it involves walking around, but also it's a kind of a white collar job. So you're using your head, you're not physically picking stuff up and lifting stuff or whatever else. And the last few years, especially as I've got older, I've run my own supplement company and whatever else. So I tend towards jobs now. It's a bit more using your head if you're still walking around, and then as a little physical work as possible, which is great for the gym, of course.
So Mobster, you're obviously a big guy. You're obviously strong. Give some advice to our listeners. You know, we got a wide variety of listeners, but most of our listeners, you know, they want to get stronger. What have you found to be the most effective way to get stronger? Was it, you know, maybe a full body workout 3 days per week? Is it like an upper lower split? Like, what have you found out of all of your years of training that really, you know, put the size and strength on you?
If I was talking about the average Joe, the 3 times a week, high intensity type stuff, 40 minute workouts around the compounds, pretty much worked for me for a very, very long time. And in fact, if I didn't train my grip and didn't do the specific strength stuff and only did a workout to enhance my total body strength, I'm only training 3 days a week on that stuff right now. So like if depending on my work rate and my schedule, one day is legs, another day is chest and back, and then the final day would be shoulders and arms. And I my personal preference is for a low volume approach, which pretty much works for strength as well. You need a slightly higher volume, higher rep approach for bodybuilding, but for strength, low volume stuff. And then it's a question of percentage of max. Find out what your max is, or as close to your max is, and then percentage of max. You can argue the toss between 3 sets of 3, 4 sets of 4, 5 sets of 5, but all of that stuff still relatively low compared to what a bodybuilder would do. And then I think the biggest thing, which I've talked about many times, both on the forums and in person, is learning how to get the most out of your workout. That's a bit of a trick that some people never learn. And that's why they get coaches and trainers. I'm sure that all the guys that we're talking to right now, the moderators, would have a pretty good idea how to get the best out of themselves. Some people don't. And we could probably take someone for strength training and really push them for a gut-busting workout, and it might only be 5 sets of 5 reps. Whereas other guys could go in, not choose a decent percentage of max, do five sets of five and feel like they could do another workout. But we could make them really push
themselves. I agree completely. You know, like you often hear people say like, oh, well, I work out for 2 hours, you know? Yeah. But if you,
I work out for 2 hours, but I'm a lazy son of a bitch. I only do four exercises and maybe 12 sets. But that 2 hours doesn't mean enough. That's because I'm too busy talking and having coffees and chatting to the girls.
You're having a social workout, not a real workout. You know, yeah. I always ask, like, what the heck are you doing in there for 2 hours? You know, and then if you actually...
I know what I'm doing.
they're chatting for 5 minutes between sets. They're walking to the water fountain. They're having, you know, a nice sip of water. Then they're going to the bathroom four or five times. Like, they're kind of like, la-di-da, not a care in the world. You know, like, yeah. I tell all of my clients, train like you're late for work, you know? Train like, hey, I got an hour to do this workout. In an hour, I got to be out of here. You know, I got an important meeting. Like that go, go, go mentality, you know, and just tell people, you know, like people understand. You know, if someone comes up to you and they want to talk, just say like, hey, man, like I'm pressed for time. I got a meeting after this. Let's chat after, you know, hit me tomorrow or give me a call after, something like that. Yeah.
There is an argument with regards to strength training and bodybuilding, which is the rest and recovery stuff, the in-between sets. So, for example, and you and I and Steve, I'm sure, will know something of the science of this, which is for a bodybuilder, a set should only take somewhere between a minute to 75 seconds, and rest and recovery should be about 2 minutes, sometimes a little bit less, especially if it's more fitness-orientated, less bodybuilding. With strength training, especially if it's a higher percentage of max, up to 5 minutes, which means I can do a workout if I'm on the clock, as I call it, looking at the clock, want to get out in a certain time. Even a strength workout can be an hour and a quarter. A bodybuilding workout can be done in 45 minutes. But that's full-on intense. You're almost on the cusp of being out of breath all the time. For a strength workout, again, and I know that because it works for me, today was a two-hour workout, but it was only four exercises, probably no more than 3 to 5 sets per exercise. And yes, that included going to the front desk and having a coffee with the gym owner and then getting back. If I feel like I'm cooling down, then I know that I spent too much time talking or too much time sipping coffee and whatever. But yeah, the bodybuilding stuff, the fitness stuff and the strength stuff pretty much comes down to the set rep range and the rest and recovery between sets. A bodybuilding workout needs to be a much faster paced workout if it's done properly than a strength workout. But even if the sets and reps are exactly the same, the rest and recovery in between and a percentage of max is different.
It's 100% correct. Because, you know, with bodybuilding, your goal is to stimulate the muscle. So you actually don't want too much rest between sets because then some of the blood is going to start to flow out of the muscle, which is what you don't want.
100%. You and I both know, for example, that I could do, as I did today, my chest workout was flat barbell bench press close grip. That was it, nothing else. And I think all the warm-up sets and everything all together only come to 5-6 sets total. Whereas a bodybuilder, you and I could take a bodybuilder for a workout and it would probably be something like some sort of chest fly type movement and then straight onto a bench press movement. And the whole thing could be 4 sets of each and we wouldn't give that guy a break for 10 minutes and his chest would be pumped like a bitch.
So, Steve, let me ask you a question about your diet. Can you give us an idea of how a diet would be different from a bodybuilder fitness guy versus a strength athlete or power lifter, more what you do?
Okay. I've got some very big friends in the strongman world. And if you read some of the online articles and see the TV and YouTube interviews and whatever else, because a couple of them have been interviewed by the BBC over here. They're talking about 10 or 12,000 calories a day. I'm not that excessive, but these guys weigh over 300 pounds. They're 330, 340, 350. A couple of them are close to 400 pounds. So they need a lot more calories. And sometimes the volume of work they're doing is a lot higher. The number one thing is we don't give a fuck about body fat. We really don't. Most of us, myself included, are too damn big that we're not going to get down to middleweight. We're not going to get down to lightweight. So I'm too heavy in myself to compete in the lighter classes. So I don't care. I can have that type of ice cream. It's not a problem. But realistically, one of the things I said about strength training stuff is we learn from bodybuilders, like a lot of athletes do, because you're using your nutrition as a tool. So the post-workout protein, the high-protein meals, the rest and recovery stuff, the using the supplements or whatever else to enhance our training and enhance our recovery is important. I probably don't eat much more than 3,500, 4,000 calories a day, but then I weigh 280, give or take. So, as I said, some of my 330, 350-pound buddies are probably having 7,000, 8,000 calories a day. Their bulk actually helps them lift heavier weights as well. So that extra calories, those extra food, is part of what they do. And sometimes the guys are going to burn more calories. One of my buddies put up a video a couple of days ago. He's a top 10 world's strongest man competitor, and he's just pulled 400 kilos. And you've had Eddie Hall do the speed rep on Instagram with 450 kilos. They're going to burn some calories pulling up 400 kilograms, more than I would, more than you would.
So before we get into like some of the hardcore topics, I want to follow up on this too. Can you give us a specific idea of your daily diet? Because you're a big guy, you're lifting heavy ass weight. What are you guys, you big heavyweight power lifters? I was a power lifter, but I competed in the 129 weight class.
That power, that's pounds,
129.
Yeah.
129. The lowest weight class was 119. I was 129. Yeah. So that was many years ago. I'm a bigger guy now, but. So a big heavyweight powerlifter, what is a daily diet? Give us an idea of what your, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, snack.
I'm told when people see what I eat that they think I'm – I was told that I was doing a Desperate Dan, which is a cartoon character from a comic over here. And it was the old joke about they imagined that I was wiping a cow's ass, breaking the horns off, and that was what I was eating. But I don't actually eat excessively. I would probably just have an oatmeal style breakfast and a cup of tea in the morning. I'll have a couple of cups of coffee. This is on the day when I'm going to the gym, a couple of cups of coffee, then I'm off to the gym. So I'm probably not having more than 500 or 600 calories before I leave the house, but I can train that suits me. One of the things I talk about nutritionally is, of course, what I ate last night and what I ate yesterday afternoon is as important as what I'm having for breakfast in terms of what I need to go to the gym with. When I talk to the other guys, they will have at least two meals before they get to the gym. So they'll have that breakfast and then they'll have something mid-morning. Some of the guys are mad for the high-protein shakes and high-calorie shakes, but they tend to be over 300 pounds again.
So what specifically are you eating for breakfast? Like what's
today was just oatmeal, a bowl of oatmeal and a cup of tea before I come down and had two cups of coffee and left the house. In an ideal world, I'd probably have some scrambled eggs on toast, but I'm too damn lazy to cook that much food in the morning.
So then what did you have for lunch? What did you have after your workout?
I had to go into town for an appointment today, so I grabbed a bowl of pasta from the local supermarket and ate that on the way to town. Probably not as much as I would normally have. I would probably have a little bit more, probably 500 grams of some sort of pre-prepared pasta thing. But I didn't want to walk around a supermarket and get that, so I'd have it slightly smaller. But I would normally have...
What about like a typical dinner then? Like what? How are you getting all those calories is what I'm trying to get at. Is it a lot of pasta? Is it a lot of eggs?
This goes back to something that you and I were slightly different over, and I've seen conversations online. For me, it's three meals a day, three protein shakes a day, and protein shakes at the minute are including some carbohydrate powder thrown in there. So for today, the evening meal, what did I have in the evening meal today? Four beef burger patties and some potato and some carrot. So that was probably, I think, weight wise. And I do check the calorific content of food. If I can eat a whole pizza, that's 900 to 1,000 calories for me. If I have an evening meal, it's probably at least 1,000 calories, give or take, just for the sheer volume of food that's on the plate.
So you basically do meal, shake, meal, shake, meal, shake. Is that
pretty
is that
much? Yeah.
And then your shakes, is that just a whey protein, or are you adding things like peanut butter and stuff like that to increase the calories?
I'm very boring in that regards. Even when I had my own supplement company, it would be unflavored whey protein concentrate and quite a lot of it. I think at one point I was consuming 300 grams of powder a day, so about 240 grams of protein just from the shakes. That was 100 grams per shake. Slightly less than that in a minute. It's probably 50, 60 grams per shake at the minute. And at the minute I'm putting in... I'm using some Need to Build Muscle protein, and I'm putting some carbohydrate powder, and I've also got some unflavored whey concentrate, which I'm adding in there as well. So there's probably, with the carbohydrate powder, probably about 80 grams of powder in the shake. So it's quite a large shake, but it's not sugary. I have done the fruit thing in the past. I have put stuff into there. when a flavor gets boring. I made the mistake years ago of buying 5 kilos of one particular flavor, and I don't care how much you like a flavor. If you've had 5 kilos of it day in, day out, you'd find that as a big mistake. So I'm okay with unflavored, and I tend to have a bit more sensible now and have other flavors in the house. No matter how great a flavor is, no matter how much we rant and rave about it, if you've had it for like 6 weeks on the trot, it drives you mental.
So to switch gears a little bit from food, can you give us an idea of maybe some of the more popular compounds as far as steroids, insulin, for example, on what the bigger athletes, the strength athletes, the powerlifting guys, what would they use versus, you know, what we typically hear from a bodybuilder on the forums all the time?
Yeah. Just to jump into the Matt's question there, like for the guys who are eating, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10,000 calories per day, are they using insulin to, you know, help their body utilize that much food, or like
that I'm aware of. We would have occasionally when I had all the strength guys and we were all competing in different facets of strength. We had an MMA guy that was on the TV. We had the world's strongest man competitor who should remain nameless while we're talking about drugs. We had amateur and 105 kilo strongmen. That's 231-pound strongmen. And, of course, myself as a grip guy and a couple of other fellas coming in there. We would sit down and have these conversations towards the end of the afternoon if we'd been doing strongman-style training or whatever else. Test Infinite was a big popular basis for most of their steroid regimes. I never got off on it. It didn't seem to do much for me, but most of the guys would swear by that. We've mentioned on the forums, the bigger guys will struggle as much as the new guys, bodybuilders, would struggle with Tren, but Tren is a fantastic drug for their strength. The only problem you've got is the same thing that everybody else suffers from. When you weigh 330 to 350 pounds and you get the Tren sweats, you really get the Tren sweats. You know, changing T-shirts of a night time, getting out of bed and having to change the sheets, because they're big guys, they've got higher body fat and they're taking Tren. I've also had conversations where short cycles of growth hormone have been thrown in there, mostly for tissue repair. They're not trying to get lean. They're not looking for healthy skin or shiny hair or great looking fingernails and all the small things that we know that growth. They're looking for tissue repair. They're breaking down tissue. They're damaging tissue. And if like myself, although I've never used it, if you're pushing for a world record, you're taking your body into a place that the body hasn't been before in your particular field of strength. They've got bicep tears, they've got pec tears, they've got quad tears. And the growth hormone was used as a tissue repair compound rather than for musculature, rather than for any of the health benefits that we know that it can give. There'll be other stuff in there, but then that's when we start to argue about it. And then you also get dose dependent. Most of these guys are like top bodybuilders. When some of these guys are 230, 240 pounds when they left school and they've gone up to 300 pounds. Most of them are much taller than average, much bigger than average before they even put any hands on a barbell. So their response to gear, it's surprising how little they use in comparison to some of our forum members. I know for a fact that I was probably using more, and I've never been a high user, as I've mentioned online, more in So my highest time, which I've mentioned online, I think was 765 milligrams total of whatever the hell I was using at the time, when the world's strongest man competitor, as he literally did not take any gear until he qualified for the world's strongest man and then took less than me in the first year that he competed in the world's strongest man. These guys are very high responders to that kind of stuff. There will be the odd one or two that are excessive, but most of them less than a gram a week. And insulin, to the best of my knowledge, it's never been something that we've discussed. So I'm guessing the answer is no.
So, but in Britain, the laws in Britain with steroids are what exactly? Is it legal to use but not legal to sell?
Sale and distribution is illegal. I know that we have something the same as you have in America, that using the postal service to send it, that's a law in and of itself. It's archaic, but it's a law in and of itself. So you've got restrictions on the courier and carrier companies, but the post office prohibits you using the post office to send steroids through the post. So that would be a law broken in and of itself. Over here, we had some test cases, and I know two fellas
the late Paul Borison and Mick Hart, who were both asked to represent bodybuilders or athletes that had been caught in possession of steroids in court. And the test cases essentially were thrown out on the basis of there was nothing defined in British law to say how much is for personal use versus how much is definitely for sale and distribution. So guys were caught with lots, you know, 10 mm-hmm. amps, 10 vials, whatever else. And the police would go and grab them and arrest them. And it goes to court and the court would throw the case out because there was nothing in the statute books to say what was allowed and what wasn't allowed. I've also heard stories of guys that were brought through suitcases of steroids into customs and declared themselves at customs with these suitcases full. And a keen new customs officer got very excited, and his senior officer said, "You just charge them the VAT, son. There's nothing written down about how much they're allowed to bring in." So the laws like that. I think the main thing in the United Kingdom, and we know that this is how it really works in America, for the most part, the only reason that there's illegality connected to steroids is because drug dealers and the people distributing steroids are required to be criminals. And the reality of it is that the user, the end user, tends not to be a criminal. He doesn't mug, he doesn't go out robbing, he has the disposable income. We know that, I think the American statistics bear this out, he's typically an educated white male with the disposable income. He's not a lawbreaker, he's not a criminal. He's only breaking the law when he buys the bloody stuff and uses it. He's not actually a criminal, he's not going out and breaking the law to get the money to buy a steroid cycle. Right. That only happens when it becomes illegal. So you get into that thing. So in the United Kingdom, although there is obviously some argument about the stepping stone from one drug to the next, for the most part, we can get it quite easily in spit and sawdust gyms. We don't pay excessive prices.
But is it good quality gear? That's what I'm trying to get at. Because in the United States, our domestic gear is watered down shit from China. I mean, it is watered down shit that guys make in bathtubs. So your gear that you're using is probably dosed good. That's why you're saying these guys are only using under a gram a week. In America, guys, 3 grams.
I think that we get the same underground stuff that you do. Yeah? The main problem, I've always thought this, and I had actually a conversation with a guy that set up a lab the other day, quite by surprise when he announced it to me. And I think the reality of the situation is probably thus, right? When you start up a lab, you produce fantastic gear, and the reputation for this fantastic gear gets around and everybody goes crazy. But the trouble is the margin, the profit on producing real high quality gear when you're competing against stuff that is not high quality means that you are stuck between producing less of a profit because you do want to make some money, even if it's just to pay for your own gear, or charge more than everybody else, but for high quality gear. I think we get the same problems that you get in regards to what it says on the bottle is not necessarily what's in the bottle. So we get that particular problem. There's a famous steroid guru over here, Dave Crossland, who did one of his documentaries when he showed you how simple it was. He had the steroid maker create it for him in a lockup on one of his DVDs, on his documentary, how quick it was. We get the same stuff in that documentary. They showed that the powder come from China. He mixes it up and literally cooks it in a microwave and brings it out prior to it being filtered before it's going into the vials. We have the thing over here where we can go to drug support centres and get sharps, bins and needles and syringes and all that stuff for free. That's quite easy. I would probably say we have a better, but not necessarily a greater, access to stuff over here. It's easier for sure. We're in the United Kingdom where you guys was in California about 10 or 15 years ago, where you could go to your steroid dealer's boot, the trunk of his car, and he would open up and say, "What do you want?" We can kind of do that. So long as we're doing it in front of a police officer or somewhere, you know, it's that simple over here.
It's like the way pot is now in California or Colorado, some of those more Western states, you know.
There's stories from 1980 where the guys would open up their holder in the back of the trunk of their car outside the gym and say, "What do you want? What do you want?" We're kind of like that. Whether that will change, whether we're criminals will get greedy, whether we've 100% got what we think it says on the label inside is a whole nother conversation. It probably is what you say it is in terms of the strength athletes. I think one of the things which is kind of cool in its perverse way is that the more of a face, the more of an athlete that you become, that people know you to be, the easier the access becomes, which is great. For obvious reasons, he says with a silly grin on his face.
So I got a question for you, Mobster. SARMs, selective androgen receptor modulators, have become immensely popular here in North America.
Yes.
Have they started to, you know, pick up popularity in the UK? Because I was thinking Nutrabol, an HGH analog, which also increases appetite. I think that would be, you know, like a powerlifter's best friend. You know, you're going to get some water retention. It's going to increase HGH levels in the body. So, you know, your joints are going to feel good. And then it also increases appetite. So I think like powerlifters, if they could get their hands on some Nutrabol, would just love it. It'd be like, you know, like Christmas came early.
I've seen, I've not looked at UK forums on the steroids or peptides or anything, probably for about 12 months. But when I last looked, peptides were being discussed 100%. Prohormones, as per one of the posts on the forum this week, are still a big deal. There's a couple of companies over here I can think of. I could find that if I looked them up. The SARMs, not so much, although I have seen some older posts, but they were kind of rare, probably because of the conversation that we've just had, which is the access to steroids, good, bad, or otherwise, is so relatively easy in that particular way. It's probably more expensive and more difficult, because it's probably going to come from outside of the UK anyway, to get hold of SARMs than it is actual steroids. The main thing which is a problem, regardless of any of those particular hormonal products, is the lack of education. There are guys that shouldn't be taking steroids that are taking steroids because they haven't got a clue what they're doing, what they're taking, what the action is, what the side effects are, and whatever else. And that, again, that comes down to the ease of access. It's so easy to get the damn stuff, regardless of where you are in your training thing, that they can get steroids so easily that SARMs would probably be more difficult to get hold of, more expensive to get hold of, and in fact, probably more beneficial for them. They don't know because they're not bloody educated enough. And that comes down, again, to ease of access. It's so easy. It's almost stupid and kind of disappointing from my perspective, only as someone with experience and whatever else, and hopefully a little bit of knowledge, that they shouldn't be using that just yet until they know how to use it. And so therefore the stepping stones from SARMs and to steroids to more advanced active peptides should be one thing after another, but people tend to go straight to the front of the queue, not look at the back of the queue. And because steroids are that much more easy to access here in the United Kingdom, it's probably more popular for that reason, and price wise it's probably cheaper.
What about yourself, Mobster? Have you experimented with SARMs at all?
No, I've got some here now, and I plan on trying something out in a not too distant future. The only time I've taken a steroid cycle that wasn't connected to the competition many years ago was the very first one, and I should probably do the same with the SARMs, to take them out of competition to see what my response is, see what my results are, and therefore it'd be much easier for me to recommend their use, et cetera, based on the experience that I've got, and obviously then apply the same information and experience to a competition if the SARMs give me that very result that we hope that they do.
What SARMs specifically?
At the minute, he says, looking. Well, I've got some S4, and it says G on the bottle. I have Carterine.
Yeah,
that's it. I will say it wrong. It's the two together, used in the right way, should be a good strength cycle.
Strength and endurance. Yeah, that'd be a very good cycle. So, yeah, I'm definitely excited to hear your thoughts on that. Matt, I know you wanted to hop in with a question.
Yeah, I want to be selfish and ask a question to help me, since we have an expert on. So I've never been a really strong guy. I've always trained more for size and how I look. And I'm the odd guy where my squat has always been better and heavier than my deadlift. And I don't know why. I've had my form looked at. I don't feel like it's my grip. But after hearing you talk, I feel like it probably is something to do with my grip, as well as just, you know, how I'm lifting. So do you have any just general tips for guys like me that they can squat heavier than they can deadlift?
There's an argument for what some of the things that we end up doing in the gym is where we have a talent or successful. So for example, being my squat's not great. My deadlift is better. And yet perversely, grip-wise, I've never had a fantastic deadlift. They're just that pretty much every form of deadlift there is, up to about 500 pounds, whether it's one hand, two hands, thick bar, thin bar, whatever, frames or whatever else. I can do the bloody lock because of my hand strength. My hand strength is probably disproportionate to my deadlift. I'm only a respectable deadlifter, a respectable bench press, and a respectable squatter. How tall are you? That's a good question. In terms of your...
I'm a short guy. I'm only 5'7".
Right, so then you've got... So if you look at some of the all-time fantastic deadlifters who aren't necessarily super heavyweights or whatever else, they have longer arms relative to their frame. Eddie Hall's a good example of a guy that if he wasn't allowed to use straps in competition, which was a big argument when he did his 500 kilos, would he be able to do the 500 kilos that he'd done? The answer's probably no. Again, he weighs 200 bloody kilograms for that particular lift, so it's thing. But again, I'm just thinking of the best bench pressers. The best bench pressers who had short arms and a fucking massive chest. The best deadlifters had long arms and a relatively short torso. And the best squatters would have short legs, short torso. They're just going to be short. Again, it's a proportionate thing. All of the super heavies are going to be tall. But if we take away the super heavies because they're freaks of nature and we look at all the middleweights down the lightweights, Lamar Grant, practically double jointed in the back. I think he had a slight curvature of the spine and his hands looked like they were down by his fucking kneecaps. That's before he bent down to pick up the bar off the floor. My advantage is big hands, which I can wrap around a thicker bar, and I can pretty much do, as I said already, the same weights, whether it's a one-hand deadlift, a two-hand deadlift, a double overhand deadlift, thick bar deadlift, whatever. It's very little of much above 500 pounds. You would probably be perfect for squats just by virtue of your height and your shorter levers. And the simple fact of the matter is that for you to go from a squat position to a standing position is a matter of inches. It's probably twice that for me. So you would probably out-squat me by 50 or 60% for that very reason. If you're a competitive athlete, and I found this out years ago, I used to be fantastic on a couple of lifts, but really poor on the rest. And it took me 3 or 4 years to get the lifts I wasn't good at up to a stand where I would become competitive in the overall standing. So I could win a gripper portion of a competition and I'd win that every single time. And then I'd be coming next to last on everything else. And so my ranking, I'd go first place on the first event and then fifth or sixth place on all the rest of the events and come fourth or fifth overall. When I got to a decent standard, even on my poor lifts, which for me would be a squat, so up to 400 or 500 pounds, that brought my averages up, that brought my overall total up, and that got me into the rankings. I think it's just recognition of those kind of things. You're great at squatting, you're shorter and closer to the ground than I am, so therefore that would be the thing to go for. What I would get you to do is I would get you to work the deadlift as though there was money on it. I'd get you to work the deadlift as though it was keeping you out of prison, and I would see where your form was poor. I would break the lift down. Strength athletes do this quite a lot, whether it's for the grip competition or for strongman competitions. Someone like me can come in and see another athlete and say, right, this is the other event that you need to be doing, your support lifts, the other lifts that need to get this lift in the competition better. And what I found with a lot of the strength athletes when they've come to me, these are guys that are on the TV, grip has probably been the one thing where they're failing. And they've come to me because they realise there's a competition they can't use straps in, or there's a competition where they're going to use a frame that they don't like with thicker handles that they don't like. That guy knows about grip, he'll do it. All of us should recognise where we're not as good as we should be, and we should bring up that thing. In a bodybuilder, it might be narrow shoulders. In a powerlifter, it might be not a great squat. In a tennis player, it might not be able to last if he has a long match. And sometimes we need someone else to come in and recognise that that's the failing, that's the weakness, and if we could bring that weakness up, we become competitive. So unfortunately, from experience and whatever, I've been able to do that with myself. And with a guy like you, as I say, listen, if you squat on Monday, let's get you the deadlift on Monday. Let's change your hand spacing. Let's try speed work as well as max rep work, that kind of stuff, and high percentage of max work. Let's get you to do stuff off the blocks. Let's get you to do partials. Where in a deadlift are you weak? Are you weak from the floor? Are you weak from the top? Things like this. And I would break that down and look at it and watch you. I'm remembering Louis Simmons talking about how guys would, he said, babies know how to squat when they go to the toilet on a potty. So why do I have to teach powerlifters how to squat? Because we've become so technical to move the bar from A to B, we've actually forgotten the most basic parts. And sometimes I think Louis said he had to get the guys to go back to squatting with no weights, just the bar, to remind them what they're supposed to be doing before you put weights back on the bar. Silly things like that.
I think that's brilliant. I mean, that just proves how knowledgeable you are, like, you know, using your strengths to your advantage. I remember when I competed, we had, you know, the bench press and we had clean and jerk, and I'd always be strong as fuck on the bench press, small limbs, small hands. Bench press was my strength. Clean and jerk was not. And then the long lanky guys, they'd struggle on the bench press and they kick ass on a clean and jerk. So it just depends on that. So you hit the nail on the head on that for sure. So that's one of those.
We're always going to, I think one of the things that I've done with the hand strength test is it's such a tactile sport, because I've done expo work, and at expos that you can get tons of people walking by to try stuff, and they will get an immediate response and feeling from the gripper because literally of the nerve endings in your hand. And of course, what we all do in the gym is we like to train the things that we get a great response from. So if we get a fantastic pump from bicep curls, we like the bicep curl. If we get a fantastic pec pump, we like the bench press. If there's a strength athlete, I can out bench press everybody else, and I want to bench press all the damn fucking time. Recognition of your weaknesses and bringing those weaknesses up to become a competitive athlete is where the successful guy will hit. If you've got Phil fucking Heath, 6, maybe 7-time Mr. Olympia, still being coached, if you've got these top guys still being coached, you and I, as moderators, we go, we know.
Looks like we got some type of technical difficulty.
Let's give him like 10 seconds. What do you say?
We're in the Matrix, boys.
What did you say, Matt?
It's not funny anymore, but I said, we're in the Matrix, boys.
Dude, that's so like 2001.
Yeah, well, I haven't done anything since I've had kids and been
married. I'm surprised, Trevor, you know what the Matrix is.
Yeah, Steve, you're usually all over the movie jokes, and I don't even get them, but...
Matrix was just getting popular as I was like in junior high.
Okay, we got Steven.
Got Mobster back. Yeah. Mobster, we lost you there. You're saying something about Phil Heath?
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're a top athlete, whether you're a jockey or a professional bodybuilder or a strength athlete, I'll give you an example with my strongman buddy. He went down and trained with a fella who was one of the best squatters as a heavyweight in the country called Dave Beattie at Genesis Gym in Wembley, just outside of London. And he would travel down from Gloucestershire to Wembley, it's about 200 miles, to squat. And you hear about this stuff with the strength athletes. Phil Heath is the Mr. Olympia and still has a coach. And we know that the top fellas, not just because they have the income and they can afford to do it, they want to guarantee their success, but they recognize that their ability to focus in the last few weeks of a competition when they're not getting enough food in, they're not as comfortable and as happy as they are out of season, they recognize that their heads are not going to be straight. They recognize that this guy can bring them into the shape that they need to be in. They recognize that the money that they pay them is worth the investment. And as a strength athlete, as a bodybuilder who's not professional, we recognize that some things that we want to be better on, we need to improve.
Did we lose you again, Steven?
It seems like we're having some technical difficulties with Mobster. We only had about 10 minutes left anyways. One thing I wanted to bring up was the fact he mentioned Phil Heath. The Olympia is this weekend, and no one's talking about it at all, which kind of just goes to show you that bodybuilding's dying. You know what I mean? The Olympia is literally this weekend, and I haven't heard a single person on the forums, you know, mention anything.
What channel is it going to be on? Oh, we got Steven back. Steven, we only got 10 minutes left. We were just talking about the Muslim, but I really need to ask you this question. Obviously, by your accent, you're in Britain, correct? So
London first, Wales now.
So over there, I'm sure it's different. You're probably more urban, I'm guessing, because there's a lot more people in a smaller area. Like, where do you work out? Is it like a garage warehouse type of gym? Is it a franchise gym? Where do you guys usually work out?
It's what you would call a warehouse style gym, probably about 3,000-4,000 square foot, something like that.
But is it like corporate owned, or is it like, yeah?
Oh, no. This is just what we call spit and sawdust. There are many chain gyms over here. Planet Fitness like you've got over there, and we've got a few places like that there. You have those $10 gyms in America. We've got the $10 gyms over here.
Okay.
They wouldn't be.
So this place is owned by one of the guys that works out with you, and he charges you a membership. How does it work there?
I'm in the fortunate position that I don't have to pay.
Okay. Yeah.
But so yeah, the gym owner likes me. I don't have to pay. But if it, in a normal sense, the situation that there are, because we live in what we call the valleys of Wales up here, there's plenty of hardcore places. The closer you get to London, the more corporate gyms there would be, the more chain gyms there would be, and the less likely I'd be getting free membership, that's for sure.
And then do you guys, like, you know, like how many people are in our members, you think, at your warehouse little gym? It's like,
yeah, like building on that, how popular is, you know, the hardcore scene, you know, people who are serious about, you know, their training, not just people who are going and, you know, using the cardio equipment 3 days per week. Like, how is bodybuilding as a you know, a niche in the UK? Is it big, or is it kind of underground?
I know that from when I had my supplement company, the first year that we started, which was 2003, I believe the sports supplements, that's protein powders, creatine and a lot, not health foods, was worth something like £200 million UK wide that year or the couple of years beforehand. And that's increased by, I think a couple of years ago, was up to 400 million. So that would probably be over 10 or 11 years, over a decade, so it doubled. And it's increased all the time. So even if you took the niche bodybuilding stuff and then you threw the rest of the market in as a market as a whole, we've doubled, and we're probably going to treble that in the next couple of years. So I think that might be down to disposable income. It's an awareness, the internet and YouTube making it more popular in that particular way. It still means that your chain gyms are going to be packed with the guys paying £10 a month, but it means, fortunately for the smaller gyms like the kind of place I'm using, they're able to survive. They're probably able to survive because they sell steroids and whatever else, but still, yeah. Sports supplements are very popular.
I just want to ask one more question because I know Matt wants to get in, but who are your big fitness celebrities there that everyone knows, like in the gym? Like here, if you ask anyone in the gym who Arnold Schwarzenegger was, everyone would know who he is. He's like the big guy, even though he's not even American, but he immigrated to the United States and he became huge. If you ask people who Ronnie Coleman was in my gym, I bet you probably 20% of guys might know. Not even. So everyone knows who Arnold is here. Who's the guy in Britain? Who's your big superstar in Britain that everyone knows there?
The last couple of years, because it's been on the TV, because it's been in the newspaper, and because this year he became World's Strongest Man, I'd probably say Eddie Hall. He's popular just for himself and because he's become the World's Strongest Man. So non-bodybuilders and non-strength athletes know who that guy is. Arnold is 100%. You could ask that from one top of the country to the bottom of the country, and anybody that goes to a proper gym would know who Arnold Schwarzenegger is.
So you guys follow a lot of American pop culture when it comes to our movies, our music and stuff, correct?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I would say with regards, and this is just from a perspective of being the older fella, we tend to be about 6 months to a year behind America, pretty much, with the pop culture. What you do there, within 6 months, we're doing it here, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, on that basis. Sadly, guys like me, you could say Lou Ferrigno was in Pumping Iron, and you walk around my gym, they probably wouldn't know who he is. Arnold Schwarzenegger, they'd know who he is. Eddie Hall, to a lesser degree, but they'd recognize him for who he is. Outside of that, your guess is as good as mine, because I'm so old school and hardcore, I probably know everybody that you know, but I wouldn't know necessarily what the general population would recognize. You still get asked the same damn questions that you were asking in 1970 by some of the older fellas over here if they think you lift weights. So
no, yeah. there's a really good Netflix video on Eddie Hall. If you guys out there listening are interested and you check it out, it's really well done. I watched it a few months ago and really enjoyed it.
He's got a book coming out on Amazon, I believe at the end of the month. So they're actually doing his biography. I've seen the same documentary that you're referring to. It's very good. He cries in the middle. He realizes the sacrifices his family has made. It's very good. That's probably one of the reasons he's become liked.
And he's one of those guys that is
well on TV.
He's one of those guys who is eating over 10,000 calories a day.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's crazy.
He's
so
dropped
Steve,
30
just...
kilos since he won the World's Strongest Man. He's down to about 160, 170, but he was 200 kilos or close to 200 kilos for the World's Strongest Man. Huge.
So just as a last question for me, kind of what's next for you? Now, you're 53. You plan on competing for how much longer? Like, what's kind of next for you?
Ever since I hit 50, I've been going, you've got to be careful, son. Any day now, your strength's going to start waning, your body weight's going to start dropping. Old age will kick your ass. And apart from that little warning bump last year with the injury, it's a good question. I'm not on anything right now. And there's some lifts and events I'm doing in the gym right now, that's the best I've ever done. So it's perverse. Probably because I've been training for such a long time, I've been able to maintain the strength. The question becomes, when I start losing, when I can't maintain my body weight and the strength on certain lifts, that's probably the time I need to shift gears. That's probably the time I need to readjust. We know bodybuilding, strength athletes, whatever else, a lot of guys can't get their head around it, hence the gear and all these kind of things. If strength was that important to me, I'd be on steroids all the time. If I compete next year and I'm fourth or fifth or something like that and I start to fall off the places and I know that I can't be as strong as I need to, then I need to shift gears. Right now, that doesn't happen, so we shall see what happens next. I take 1 year at a time at the minute, so very much on that basis.
Well, you're kind of transitioning this already, Mobster. I mean, you're focusing less on your own training, you're helping others. I mean, you're a great asset to the forums. You know, we love to have you. You know, you're a great addition to the team. You know, I'm kind of the nutrition guy. I really love bodybuilding. Steve, he knows everything about steroids. I mean, he's like the chemical guru, the new Dan DeShane. Matt's the nice, you know, family man who kind of tells people how to keep everything in balance and how to live, you know, that happy American dream lifestyle. And then we got this huge Britain guy with an accent who can lift 1,000 pounds over his head like it's nothing. So
one of the things that we're all doing, and which I think every single one of us as moderators will appreciate, is that I was told by some old guys when I first came into the sport that we stand on the shoulders of those that went before us, and we love the sport and we love what we do so much that we want to share that knowledge. I think we would share that knowledge if there was just one other person on the island with us. We want to pass on that knowledge. We want to pass on the information. We're going to be the guy that's telling other people because we know that that's good for the sport. We know it's good for the members of the forums that we're on. We know that we represent something. We've achieved a certain notoriety or a certain fame or a certain level in our sport, whether it's, you know, getting paid to do expos, winning trophies, remembering that you need to smile when they're taking photographs and all this kind of stuff. And then when people come up to you, you could be tired, you could be grumpy, you could be angry, you could have had an argument with the wife, but this fellow wants to know something about bench pressing, and maybe he's a 433rd first fellow that's asked you that day. But we know that every time we pass on that information, we're spreading the message. It's, you know, the gospel, and as it comes with a certain degree of responsibility, and we're aware of that responsibility. So, you know, it makes us feel good when we do it as well. So this is all to the benefit.
Yeah, we're really glad to have you joining the moderator team on Evolutionary and Elite Fitness as well. You really are spreading a lot of knowledge. So I have one more question. I know Trevor wants to finish up the show. NFL just started. It's a big thing here in the United States. I know where Trevor is in Canada, he couldn't give a rat's ass about it. They love hockey up there. So, but we have we're exporting games to London. We have a few games being played in London. Are you going to go to any of those games? Do you really give a shit? And do you think the guys in your gym give a shit about it?
Me personally, God no. But I know of at least two or three local fellas who will stay up and watch the big game. And I'm talking about obviously the championships. The name of I forgot the bloody name of it. What's the biggest game of the
Super
year?
Super Bowl,
yes. I know of at least two guys that will stay up to God knows what time in the morning watching the Super Bowl. We've also got one of the fellas from the gym, I haven't seen him for a little while, Steve Wilson, who's a big fan of the ice hockey, and he competes over here. He takes his son to ice hockey games, and if any of the American big teams come over to the UK, he'll go to Cardiff, the Welsh capital, and he'll watch the big games as well. So yeah, stuff like that. Basketball as well. We're also getting because of the internet, of course, people can gamble on these things. So they'll gamble on them too.
So sports gambling is legal in Britain.
Oh yeah, we don't pay tax. We don't pay tax on the in betting shops. So yeah, that's okay. Cool as well.
So your sports there is soccer then. Your favorite sport probably is soccer, right? Besides
weight. Here in Wales, it's about 50-50. Rugby, because we've got some fantastic Welsh players, and soccer. When they're kids, they play more soccer. When they get older, they play more rugby.
Okay. But you call soccer football, right?
Football, yeah. Across the United Kingdom, football would probably be the sport everybody loves to follow.
What about hockey? That's Canada's sport. Do you guys care about hockey at all, or do you think that's
just... One of my local buddies, Steve Wilson, who's a bit of a strength guy on the side, big chap, he loves the ice hockey. And I know that we had a few places in London where you could go and play it. But again, way more popular than Canada. It's becoming popular over here. I think the guys that can spend
But you guys don't have an Olympic team that does hockey for some reason, even though it's cold up there. You guys don't have ice, right?
We had something in the Olympic Games where they spent a disproportionate amount of time watching hurling, which is that sort of stone that skids down on ice, and they use brushes to get it there. And because we had a chance of winning the medal, I think we got several hours of TV watching a sport that no one would watch outside the Olympics.
Yeah. They give people medals for that shit too.
Yes, I'm on about. So they brush the ice, and the stone slides on the ice. And we got four hours in the last Olympics watching various games that we would never pay any attention to the rest of the time.
Canada's good at that sport, though.
There you go. We probably thanked them.
I'm gonna say one thing, and then I'm going to close the show because we're over our hour here, Mobster. Curling, I personally find it mind-numbingly boring to watch. Canada, we kick ass at it. I mean, I think we've won every single curling Olympics. I think the reason it is so popular is because alcohol sales are the highest in curling out of any other sport. That's what it is. If you go to a curling game, everyone is so blackout drunk, they don't even know what they're watching.
It used to be like that with football. It cost about seven.
You guys had lots of fights in the stands, right, during the game?
Oh, no.
We had the same problem after our games as you used to get after the big American football games in the States. But the last time I watched a big rugby match in Cardiff, which was Wales, Italy, a couple of years ago, it was £7, so about $10 for a pint of beer. And I was like, no way, we're not having a drink at the stadium. We wait till we get back home. That's a bit more sensible. Too expensive, deliberately, maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's why the corporate's making the money back. So people can't afford to get drunk at the stadium anymore, whereas you used to be able to do that quite
easily. It's like $12 here when you go to a football game for a
bit. Yeah, that's crazy. $3 in a bar, $12 at the stadium. No way.
Mobster, I'm going to close up the show here. I just want to say, you know, we're so happy to have you, you know, as a moderator on the Evolutionary and Elite Fitness forums. I know you guys listening to this podcast is just audio, so you can't see, but Mobster, he's this bald guy. He's got this wicked beard, and he's as big as a brick house. Like, he's this super cool guy. I mean, I can tell he'd be a ton of fun to hang out with. I mean,
he's the guy you don't want to mess with in the alley. I'll tell you that.
He's the guy you'd love to get a workout in with, but at the same time, you'd be scared if you finished the workout in one piece. And I loved how you finished off the show. You know, when we were talking about what's next for you, and you said, you know, you want to teach others. And I truly believe that. I believe that once you stop learning new things, you stop progressing. And one thing I've really learned is, you know, I'm in academia. I'm doing my master's in sports nutrition. The more I learn, the more I realize how little I know. Because the more knowledge you obtain, the more you realize just how much out there is. You know, and everyone's different. You know, and one of the beautiful things about recording 125 podcasts now is that we've had on so many different guests, and you're hearing one nutritionist talk about, you know, how a high carb, low fat diet is best for the athlete. And the other person will talk about keto diets. And then, you know, our next guest is Dr. Gary. He's a big advocate of fasting. You know, it's so interesting listening to all the different viewpoints and how much information there is. So
you mentioned something very, very quickly to tie in with that we sometimes learn when we teach. So you educate yourself to the masters, and then you go out and you'll pass on that knowledge. And as you pass on that knowledge and deal with 1,000 clients and then 2,000 clients or 3,000 clients, you're learning from your clients, and you're learning as you teach by teaching, which makes you a better teacher. And that makes us better athletes. So we're getting something back from that as well. Not just a feel-good factor, but we're actually learning by teaching and by talking to clients and by seeing that variety of people and whatever else. So, yeah. One of the great things about going back to when I trained in Gloucester is we had such a variety of guys that were very good at different sports that we would learn. Like I said earlier on in the podcast, we learn from, as a strength athlete, I learn from bodybuilders nutritionally how to recover from my training. Not bodybuilders do their thing and I do my thing. No, we learn from each other. We learn from the nutrition. The more you learn, the more you teach, the more you'll learn again.
Yeah, I agree completely. My training has really changed. You know, before I was working just with bodybuilders and now I'm working with more athletes, and especially here in Canada, I'm working with a lot of hockey players, and some of the things I learned from bodybuilding, I'm now applying to the hockey players. You know, bodybuilders, you look at any bodybuilder, as soon as he's done his workout, what does he do? He drinks a post-workout shake, right? A lot of these hockey players, you know, they're finishing their game, they were showering, you know, then they would have a press conference, they would drive home. It'd be 2, sometimes even 3 hours after their game before they were getting any sort of nutrition in. So I started getting these athletes to use a post-workout shake, just, you know, get some nutrients in their body, get that recovery process started right after their game. Their recovery has been better. Their energy levels have been better. Their performance is better. That's something I learned from bodybuilding, you know? So it's not black and white. You know, you can learn a little bit from this sport and apply it. So
the obvious thing from a professional athlete's point of view, tying with that, and this actually applies to Welsh rugby and English rugby for that matter, is that you're paying a guy £100,000 a week and he's your one of your best players. You want that guy ready, willing and able to play in the next game as almost as good as he did in the last game. Maybe he was the top scorer. He scored 3 tries. He did the touchdown in NFL and won. You need that guy ready for the next game. So the moment he walks off the pitch, the moment he comes off the field of play, he needs to be straight onto his nutrition. He needs to be straight onto the physiotherapy. He needs to be recovering immediately. And not only that, just from the financial point of view, you're getting your money's worth out of this guy who's only going to be at the top of his game for 10 years. So the nutrition style that they can learn from a bodybuilder to recover quicker, to be a better athlete, to be back on the field uninjured and on $100,000 or £100,000 a week or whatever is hugely important. And yet for years, as you know, that wasn't happening. And now it is. And they're learning that from bodybuilders. They'll learn it from Ronnie Coleman. They'll learn it from strength athletes. And you and I will tell them, this is how you apply that information. I use the analogy, it's the same tools in the toolbox used for different jobs. The weights are tools, nutrition is a tool, rest and recovery is a tool. We all use it differently to get the same result as a better athlete in your chosen sport.
Great analogy, Mobster. I got to close off the show. It's been a pleasure having you on. Guys, listening to the show, if you got a question for Mobster, you want to learn how to get big, you want to learn how to get strong, just go on evolutionary.org or elitefitness.com, create a thread. Mobster will happily answer that for you. I mean, this guy is a wealth of knowledge. For your host, Trevor Caritzen, for my co-host, Steve Smee, and for my second co-host, Matt, also known as the Masonic Bodybuilder, this has been another episode of Evolutionary Radio. Live your life, look good doing it. Thanks for listening.